This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When does a $2 billion loss at one of the nation's largest banks spark a rally on Wall Street? When you're in the middle of a credit crunch and a 50% drop in profits actually looks pretty good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value. And by Clarks and Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 16th day of April. Today, the country's third largest bank, J.P. Morgan, announced a 50% plunge in first quarter profits. At Wells Fargo, they dropped by 11%. And yet, shares in both companies shot up and the Dow jumped for joy. Huh? Well, as we mentioned earlier this week, analysts were paying close attention to Wall Street's reaction to these first quarter profit reports. And as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains, today's numbers actually met or exceeded expectations.
Investors aren't just signaling they're comfortable. The damages have already been priced in. They're even pushing stock values higher. But now hear this, something else that Ted Weisberg at Seaport Securities told us to watch out for this week.
Guidance is so important, almost more important than the actual earnings themselves.
What investors heard today was J.P. Morgan chief Jamie Dimon declaring the credit crisis may be 75 to 80% through. What they didn't hear were any specifics backing up that rosy outlook. Maybe he knows something we don't, but listen closely to this exchange during a call with analysts, and maybe he doesn't.
Anything that would give you some signs of stabilization of the loss and delinquency rates in the home equity portfolio?
No, it's exactly what we saw. Higher, more houses are going negative equity, roll rates are high, home prices we expect to still go down. We have not seen it.
Dimon's formal statement today predicted economic weakness, stress in the capital markets, more credit losses and lower earnings, possibly through the remainder of the year or longer. Stay tuned to find out if these mixed signals remain cause for celebration. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And in fact, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that when Merrill Lynch posts its earnings tomorrow, it'll be kissing another $6 to $8 billion goodbye. Speaking of billions, that's what the new kings on Wall Street, hedge fund managers, raked in last year. A new survey released today shows that the top five made more than $1 billion each, even as the housing and credit markets fell down the rabbit hole. Jill Marché has that story.
The man who made the most money last year is John Paulson, $3.7 billion. That's according to Institutional Investor's Alpha magazine, which ranked the top hedge fund managers in the country today. Editor Michael Pelt says it's the largest payout in modern history.
We've got five guys on our list that in 1 year alone made enough to have purchased Bear Stearns. I mean, to us, that sort of says a lot. I mean, just, you know, the enormity of the wealth that, you know, hedge fund managers today are generating.
Paulson made his money investing in complex bets against the subprime mortgage market. When these mortgages defaulted last year, Paulson's funds rose as much as 600%. And like most hedge fund managers, he pocketed 20% of that. Paul Dorf at Compensation Resources endorses multi-million dollar packages for corporate executives, but billions makes even him outraged.
It doesn't look kosher, particularly if you dig into what they're making their money on.
He says most of the funds making huge profits
are betting on commodity prices for oil, the fact that banks are going to fail.
Paulson's investors might not agree. The pension funds, endowments, and wealthy investors who entrusted their money to Paulson appear to have gained about $15 billion for themselves, too. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
Famous people do it all the time. Hire ghostwriters. Well, drug giant Merck has apparently pulled a page from that book. An article in today's Journal of the American Medical Association claims some of Merck's academic reports on the arthritis drug Vioxx were written by company employees, and doctors were paid to put their names on the research. Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
The JAMA study claims Merck paid scientists to put their names on research articles that company employees had written about Vioxx. Dr. Joseph Ross was lead author of the study. He says his team's findings have broad implications.
It taints all legitimate research done by the pharmaceutical industry with physicians, because you can't know who designed the study. You can't know who did the study.
These practices destroy confidence in the drug industry, says James Unland, editor of the Journal of Healthcare Finance.
The broader impact is going to be an erosion of confidence in pharma companies and drugs by doctors and consumers.
Unland says drug companies are under enormous pressure to get drugs to the market as fast as possible. He says stock prices spike when a new medication gets approved by the FDA. That is, he says, until practices like these come to light.
Frankly, right now, I wouldn't own a stock of a pharma company if you put a gun to my head.
A Merck spokesman says while the drug maker often uses employees to draft research articles, the doctors who put their names on the published pieces are very involved in the research. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Wall Street partied hardy over those massive bank losses. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Concerns about a global food shortage got even worse this week. Kazakhstan suspended all wheat exports until September, and Indonesia joined several large countries in stopping all exports of rice. The situation is reaching or has reached crisis stage in many regions. Riots broke out in Haiti last week over a rice shortage. Bangladesh let the world know that it needed to import some 25,000 tons of rice. Nobody responded. Nobody. Javier Blas covers the commodities market for the Financial Times. And Javier, what is the long-term effect locally if these countries are hoarding grain supplies for the domestic market?
The impact on the domestic population is going to be that prices locally are going to go down. And that means that farmers are going to get less money. People in the cities are going to get some relief. But the bad thing for that policy is that if farmers are not getting a benefit for the rising international prices, they are not going to increase their plantation because they are not going to get extra money. That means that the crisis, instead of maybe fading away in the next few months, is going to hit us for a longer time, maybe a year or 2 years.
You know, this food crisis has been brewing for some time, months if not years, but I have to tell you, it really seems to have bubbled over in recent weeks. Why is that?
I think there are two or three factors here. The first one is that until very recently, food prices were rising, but it was mostly concentrated on the wheat market, corn, and soybean. But the new factor now is rice. Rice prices are rising, and rice is a much more political agricultural commodity. It is a staple for about 3 billion people in the planet, and between 1.5 and 2 billion people basically eat rice, and that's it.
You mentioned the price of rice, and can you give us some context for how much those prices have spiked recently?
It's absolutely incredible, the increase. In 2005, if you were to buy a ton of rice, it just cost about $250 a ton.
Okay.
That moves to about $300 in 2006 and $350 in 2007. That's on average.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of last year, we begin to see a price increase. And the price basically in December 2007, January 2008, was close to $500.
Jeez.
Today, $860.
$860 a ton?
Yes.
So in the last 3 or 4 months, the price of rice has doubled.
Yes, indeed.
Is there an element of a domino effect here, almost a panic domino, where one country decides to halt exports, and so then another does, and then another does, and so on and so on?
I think that what you are saying is a key point of the crisis now. This is a panic domino effect where every day we see a couple of more countries banning exports just because they want to insulate the country from the international market.
What happens if, say, 6 months down the road, this trend continues?
If this continues for 6 months, the global food market is going to close. Countries who rely on the global food market are going to be unable to purchase their needs. That means that hunger is going to increase in those countries, and the key critical regions to be hit, it will be Africa and Southeast Asia, but even some advanced countries in Europe.
Javier Blas, thank you.
Thank you.
While rice prices were soaring to an all-time high today, the dollar hit yet another all-time low against the European currency. It cost just shy of $1.60 to buy 1 euro. For Americans in Paris, that means a lot of window shopping in one of the world's fashion capitals. But at least tourists have a round-trip ticket home. For Yanks living abroad, the dollar's free fall demands a whole new mindset, Eleanor Beardsley reports.
I'm one of those unlucky people who earns her living in dollars and spends it in euros. I lose about 35% of what I make just by bringing it over here. Here on the streets of Paris, there are beautiful boutiques and department stores, but I don't shop anymore. I don't even allow myself to window shop. I just can't. And as a rule, I don't check the exchange rate every day. That would be way too stressful. But the moment of truth comes when I go to the cash machine. Let's see, I'm going to get out 300 euros. Every euro now costs nearly $1.60. The two currencies were equal when the euro was born in 2001. Since then, the Iraq War, record U.S. deficits, and now the credit disaster has sent it nosediving. And no one seems to know where it will stop. When I get home at night, I go on to my bank account online to see just how much those withdrawals are. It was 300 euros I got out, so that is, yikes, it's $487.73. That's frightening. Paris is still the world's number one tourist destination. It had 27 million visitors in 2007, but the tumbling dollar is beginning to scare Americans away. The Paris Tourist Board says there was a 10% drop in tourists from the U.S. in 2007. But the wimpy dollar didn't keep my friend Joyce from visiting.
I'm curious, is it reasonable to be paying 260 euros for a VIP deluxe room, and the room doesn't even have a clock?
Sitting in a cafe sipping champagne, Joyce told her friends how disappointed she was in her hotel room. But she nearly fell over when she realized how much she was actually paying for it in dollars.
My calculation is that 260 euros would be approximately $410 per night for a room with a double bed and no clock.
Now, when friends like Joyce come to town and ask me where they should shop, I tell them forget Saint-Germain or the Champs-Élysées, and I take them to a Paris street market. There are hundreds of outdoor markets every week around the city, and they're a feast for the senses, offering a smorgasbord of cheeses, sausages, and live seafood. But you can also find some pretty nice clothes and jewelry, and most importantly, you can haggle. One vendor gives me a great deal on a silk scarf and a leather handbag after I tell him I'm a poor American. Craftsman Frank Struli, who sells his chunky silver bracelets, says he sees fewer Americans now, and those who do visit his stand have changed.
American people in general, they're used to spend without normally negotiating even. And the big difference is that now you can tell something is happening because they are beginning to negotiate.
Struli, like many vendors here, will usually cut Americans a deal. They admit that while times are tight everywhere, it's really rough being an American in Paris. I'm Eleanor Beardsley for Marketplace.
Coming up, is China's breakneck growth slowing down?
Suddenly, a lot of these guys who really have been able to grow 25-30% a year by barely getting out of bed now are suddenly seeing their business move backwards for the first time.
But first, let's do the numbers. A slew of positive earnings boosted stocks higher on Wall Street today. The Dow shot up 2%, 256 points, to close at 12,619. The Nasdaq rocketed 2.8%, 64 points, to close at 2,350. The S&P climbed 2.2%, 30 points, to end the day at 1,364. Futures in crude oil today gushed as high as $115 a barrel for the first time. A sagging dollar, falling inventory, and high demand for gas were among the concerns. Financials, as we mentioned, were the big winners. Investors rewarded J.P. Morgan Chase with a 6.75% gain. Wells Fargo picked up 4.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. President George Bush meets with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown at the White House. Texas oil man T. Boone Pickens speaks at Georgetown University about the current energy crisis. And U.S. military officials announce a new federally funded institution for regenerative medicine. The center will explore new ways to help soldiers heal from wounds on the battlefield. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Today in the White House Rose Garden, President Bush called for government limits on carbon dioxide emissions. He set a target of stopping the growth of greenhouse gases in the U.S. by 2025. It's a major policy shift for an administration that has resisted curbs on the burning of fossil fuels. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the president is jumping on board a trend that already has lots of momentum.
President Bush said he's worried the courts are trying to expand decades-old environmental laws to impose expensive regulations on businesses. He asked Congress to pass economically sustainable climate change laws.
The wrong way is to raise taxes, duplicate mandates, or demand sudden and drastic emissions cuts that have no chance of being realized and every chance of hurting our economy.
In a few weeks, Congress takes up a bipartisan bill that goes much farther than the president. It requires reductions in carbon pollution by 2020. Fred Krupp at the Environmental Defense Fund says the Bush plan is too modest.
The president's goal is not ambitious enough to avert the serious economic costs of climate change. we have over 250 existing technologies that could begin to reduce emissions now. There's no reason to wait to begin reductions until 2025.
The White House goals depend heavily on technological innovations at electric power plants. Dan Redinger at the Edison Electric Institute says the president's goal may be too ambitious.
A lot of it does depend on what role not just the utility sector plays in this, but all sectors of the U.S. economy sharing the burdens, and I don't think anyone can predict right now what an appropriate timeline will be.
All sides anticipate even stricter government limits on pollution from a new administration next year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today, yet another student loan provider announced it will suspend lending at several schools. The credit crunch and a drop in federal subsidies are prompting more and more student lenders to put out not open for business signs. And all of this comes right at the time when high school seniors are making decisions about which acceptance letters to say yes and no to. Commentator David Frum says it's time we re-examine the real value of a college degree in today's economy.
Surging prices, collapsing returns, ending in a crash. Housing? Yes, but the pattern may equally apply to another area of middle-class aspiration, college education. And as high school seniors receive their fat or thin acceptance or rejection letters this month, maybe we should all take a closer look at what their money buys. Over the past decade, the cost of college tuition has approximately doubled, faster at private colleges. This rapidly inflating investment is yielding a declining return. The earnings of bachelor degree holders have been dropping this decade. After inflation, BA holders earned more than $54,000 in 2000. That dropped 5% over the next 4 years. What happened? Some point to international trade. It used to be only blue-collar workers who faced international job competition. Today, so do bookkeepers, software engineers, and certain healthcare technologists. Others cite immigration. About one in five U.S. BA holders was born abroad, nearly double the proportion of just a decade ago. Foreign BAs, especially those on temporary visas, may have less bargaining power than the native-born, exerting downward pressure on wages. Here's another thought. The proportion of Americans with a college degree continues to rise. As more and more job applicants hold degrees, have employers become more discerning about what exactly those degrees represent? Do employers look past the degree itself to the subject matter studied, the grades earned, the quality of the institution issuing the degree? If so, students, parents, and universities alike will have to ask some hard questions about value for money. Some politicians suggest that the best solution is for government to subsidize college even more than it already does. But what if subsidies are themselves the problem? Just as homeowners ignored dangerously rising home prices so long as low interest rates kept monthly payments low, so students may ignore rising tuition so long as aid and loans conceal the true cost. Colleges and universities are charging more and more for a product that seems worth less and less. You don't need a college degree to figure out. That cannot continue.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Gotten much mileage out of your college degree? Tell us about it. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Here's one of those stories where expectations play a key role in perception. Today, China reported that its economy grew 10.6% in the first quarter. 10.6%. Normally, you'd call that red hot. But the kicker here is that the growth rate is down from 11.9% last year. Uh-oh. So is China catching America's subprime cold, or is it immune, decoupled from the U.S., as the pointy-headed economists would say? It's a big debate with big implications for the global economy. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
To understand the decoupling debate, you need to know what powers the Chinese economy. Let's walk around a neighborhood in western Shanghai to get an idea. Stop one, a microphone company. The firm Shuaying exports to American recording studios. To show off the product, these factory workers have been volunteered.
如果有那么一天,
If you leave, goes the song, I will be lost, which pretty much sums up the company's situation. Founder Xu Gentang says in the second half of last year, his orders from American customers cratered by 40%.
My customers just said business is down, so late last year we had to lay off workers. And since our orders are dropping, my employees make less overtime pay.
Many exporters are hurting, especially those relying on American sales who haven't diversified to, say, Europe or the Middle East. To make things worse, costs for raw material and labor are way up.
You get a lot of people eating Rolaids or Tums who didn't used to eat Rolaids or Tums, you know.
Chip Chaikin is with a private equity firm, Blue Point Capital Partners.
Suddenly a lot of these guys who really have been able to grow 25-30% a year by barely getting out of bed now are suddenly seeing their business move backwards for the first time.
Does this mean China's in for a hard landing, that its business cycle is coupled to America's? Right now, it's a little too early to know. The pessimists say Chinese exports may fall off a cliff, creating rising unemployment and social instability.
If you're an economy that's geared to running at 11% growth a year, there's people entering the workforce and migrants moving into the cities. If your growth slows to 7%, it feels like you run into a wall at 50 miles an hour. It's every bit as bad as us going from 4% to nothing.
If Chinese factories buy fewer raw materials like oil and minerals and plastic, that hurts global trading partners and world commodity prices. But hold the pessimism as we go up the street. At this shopping mall, chipper salespersons are hawking a new milk product. It may be the Chinese consumers themselves, domestic demand, that keeps this economy humming. Spending is up 10% a year, adjusted for inflation. Take Ms. Sun. She's out here shopping for a fridge and a washer and a TV.
I'll probably buy a plasma TV. The thinner, the better. My living room's pretty big, so I'll buy a 40-inch model.
Rising lifestyles and expectations fuel this consumption boom, as does the thirst for brand names in status-conscious urban China. Again, investor Chip Chaikin.
You know, it hasn't been that long ago since you stopped seeing the Armani label on the outside of the suits. You know, the people wouldn't cut off. They would sort of leave the tag hanging on.
The last stop on our tour, a nearby construction site where a new high-rise is going up. Investment in what economists call fixed assets is the other leg of China's economy. The building of roads, train tracks, factories, and a whole lot of buildings, says Chaikin, a native of Ohio.
You hear the joke over and over again that the national bird of China is the crane. And I honestly, I can remember two, maybe three large buildings going up in Cleveland in my lifetime. You know, I look out my office window in Shanghai, I see probably 10.
And the thing about authoritarian Beijing is whenever it wants, it can snap its fingers and voila, infrastructure project. Jobs, borrowing, economic activity. And this is the China optimists see, an economy much more than just the world's factory. They argue it's largely domestically driven and decoupled from North American woes. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, an electronic family that needs help building its home, its city, and its world is celebrating a milestone. The Sims is now officially the world's best-selling computer game. Its publisher, Electronic Arts, says 100 million units have sold since the game launched 8 years ago. Apparently, the Sims world hasn't felt the effects of the subprime meltdown. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 256 points, 2%. The Nasdaq gained 64 points, 2.8%. And the S&P hiked up 30 points, that's 2.2%. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns. Next time on the program, the business strategy of social networking sites.
Stage one, attract a whole bunch of users. Stage two, we're not sure. We'll try advertising. We'll maybe try charging them for giving little cartoon puppies to each other. Stage 3 profits.
I'm Tess Viglund. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.